late show is over. And the city's fast asleep. And I'm lost in a world. That's just too cold and deep. I'm spinning like a tower.
All right. I got a special request yesterday to let's hear again from Dr. John. So that's Dr. John again with World I Never Made. But we'll be talking today on Lead Stories about developments in this horrible situation in Orlando. We are keeping pace or attempting to keep pace with the changing nature of the coverage of it, and the changing nature of how the official world is managing this mass killing as, quote, an act of terrorism, unquote. So we'll be talking about that. And the reason we're talking about it is unfolding before our very eyes. We know what happened. We know that 50 people, including the alleged lone gunman, Omar Mateen, 29 years old, died in the carnage. We know that 53 others were wounded, many of them sustaining very serious wounds. So we can expect at some point the death toll to climb. But we have a particular understanding of the context of this tragedy. And we juxtaposed it with another tragedy just last year, another mass killing in South Carolina, and how the system responded to that, how we were educated, quote-unquote, about that tragedy, the killing of 9 people in a South Carolina church, a historic church in South Carolina, Mother AME Church in South Carolina, including the person that the president insists on calling the pastor. And he was not just the pastor of the church. He was an elected official, a state senator. So this was, and I said it at the time, an assassination, a political act. So we have different ways in which the system responds in the face of awesome tragedies like this. And we find that the focus isn't on the victims anymore. Instantly, the focus is on how the tragedy can be used by the system and by various other systems to best advantage. As in the case of South Carolina, we saw that within the blink of an eye, we just didn't even discuss the victims of Dylann Roof, the young white man who walked into the church, was heartily received, well received, and then pulled out a gun and blew everybody away, the 9 people that he killed. We still don't have it as classified as an act of terror. Yet we have the President of the United States reciting the qualifications of such an act as an act of terror, the history of that kind of attack in the South and wherever it occurred throughout the United States. We have that clearly defined by none other than the President as to why that should have been declared, as it was in the case of Orlando, immediately declared an act of terror. We have in Orlando, most of the victims who are Latino, most of them Puerto Rican, who, were it not for the fact that they belong to a politically empowered and organized group, probably would have been sidelined and just be thought of as victims. We have instead political protection extended to them and political respect extended to them by virtue of their association with a global movement that insists on being recognized and respected. And this is how politics works. In and of themselves, Latinos, Puerto Ricans, and we just saw a reason recently in the primary in Puerto Rico to have a front and center discussion about the future of Puerto Rico, which is still relevant today, even in this political season. What is to be the future status of Puerto Rico? Is it to continue as a commonwealth? Is it to have statehood? Is it to be independent? That is the discussion relevant to Puerto Ricans. But many Puerto Ricans have died, have been the victims of this gunman. And because, by virtue of their affiliation with groups who have amassed their political power as gays and lesbians and transgendered people and queers, as they call themselves, many of them, and this is what is affording a certain dignity, if you will, a dignity of coverage. And it is understood that there will be a price to pay if this situation is not handled properly. But still, the system is stubborn. The system looks after its interests. And it is in the interest of the system to further advance its policy around terrorism by using this horrible tragedy this way. So the media, the very compliant press, they step in, their information largely coming from official sources, and they're playing their role. We don't see the complex analysis going on here that is warranted. Who are these people? Who were these people? How is it that Orlando becomes a magnet for Puerto Ricans? How is that accidental? Why do we see a migration to Central Florida of Puerto Ricans, leaving the mainland in very large numbers and finding new homes in the United States on the mainland and trying to make a living in a town that doesn't have very much to offer in terms of diversity of employment? You're working for Disney, essentially. You're working in jobs that would take a long time to get to by public transportation. You are committed, therefore, to earning less than you would be earning. And that's a story of migration. Migration that is happening under Barack Obama, who has seen to it that he turned more than 2 million people away. This administration has been hostile to migration. Never mind Donald Trump. Look at what's happening now under a democratic liberal administration. And we're supposed to be, enmeshed in the political conversation, which has no real meaning to us. When we look at the situation, what we want is some kind of cogent response and answer, and we're not going to get it. And that's why we have to condition ourselves to accept the limitations of the process. They're already taking care of their business and using this tragedy, highly politicizing it. And we still are not getting at the root causes and the consequence of this man's actions. See? So we discuss this as a way of educating ourselves about how things are managed for us, how information is managed, how our knowledge base is managed, and even our emotions, our thoughts, how they're being managed. And the real answers that we want and the real answers that we deserve are not going to be coming very soon. They're not there. Now, that does not stop the system and the media from believing that there's an answer for everything. There is an answer for everything. There's a reason why this man did this, and they can put it in a box. And they could tell you with some degree of certainty why he did so and so and so. Fact is, this is the nature of human beings. We have no real way of knowing what was going on in his head. But it is convenient to say, well, he pledged allegiance to ISIS. ISIS doesn't care about this guy. ISIS probably never knew of him or never heard of him. So his pledge to ISIS may just be a figment of his warped imagination. Are we dealing here with a person who was severely mentally ill, or perhaps even high on some kind of mind-altering drug? We don't know. There have been no real answers for why people who commit these kinds of crimes do them, except when they are very politically oriented. But this doesn't seem to be such a case. But it is being made into such a case, so as it is the situation in most of these kinds of cases, to make us comfortable that we know the answer to these things. We know exactly why he did it. We know exactly what he was thinking. And we know that it's not likely that we will ever know. But the politics of it, this is very important, because from time to time in our collective history, there are events that signal a move, a shift from one thing to another. And they are used very astutely. This is what propaganda is all about. This is what mind control is all about. They're used very astutely to shape our thinking so as to command conformity. Now, it is no stretch that this horrible event would lay the groundwork for a series of crazy policies that may come down the pike, and people will accept them. Not only that, they will clamor for them, they would ask for them, and they would endorse them, and they will cooperate with them. That's what explains in part Donald Trump and his successful candidacy. The implausible becomes not only plausible, but necessary. Racist, trenchantly racist policies become understandable and acceptable. And things that would ordinarily defy our sense of freedom and justice and all the high-minded things we talk about will fly with our cooperation. Because in the end, it is for our own good. This is how these things happen. So this is not just an isolated, horrible event that it is. It is part of how societies function. And this is an election year. And in this election year, we are seeing the advancement of bizarre beliefs, bizarre so-called principles and so-called values. Yeah, a little bit of outrage here and a little bit of outrage there. But essentially, there is no widespread opposition to them. There's Donald Trump going off again. He's talking that talk again. And he's dismissed as just a strange kind of character. But he is not. We have seen in other societies where things that look completely unrelated to the final consequence that comes down like a hammer on all society. And these societies go from democratic to autocratic to dictatorial. And then these events begin to matter as chief stopping points along the way in the development of ideas and policies that shape the entire nation. So this is why we're studying this, and this is why we're talking about this, because it has so many dimensions to it that we cannot ignore. We must not ignore. We should pay attention to these details because, as they say, the devil is in the details. And there's a lot of devil here. We can't ignore the inhumane way this man, Omar Mateen, dispatched all these people. I mean, it's almost incomprehensible that this would be a logical thing for anybody to do. We're not minimizing the extraordinary, the ferocity here and the extraordinary violence here. We're not dismissing that at all. We are simply saying that we have to see things in context, because this event in and of itself, we could understand it in the context of, you know, here's a person who did something awful, really awful, that flies in the face of what we collectively would consider to be a brutal thing to do. But here is a system that is also doing things to capitalize on it and to make it look like a smooth operation and to get us to accept that some things that are about to happen will be for our own good. Will be because the government loves us more than anything. It is looking out for our interests. We'll hear about the so-called values that we share. We clearly don't share so many values. We already have heard revisionist history that is now officially standard in the reporting of this event as the worst mass killing in U.S. history. It is a blatant lie. Everybody's repeating it. But it stands now as the barometer. And the media that should be checking these things out are the ones being used to report this. And therefore it becomes fact, revisionist history, that refuses to go beyond the year 2000. Just recent stuff. When you understand that mass killings, you want to talk about mass killings in this country, you just look at the history. There's no way you could escape the violence that has been part of the American historical landscape. You can't escape it. In the scheme of things, this is a continuum of American history. And if this is to be classified as terrorism, then we need to revisit history and understand how many incidents of terrorism we have already experienced to the point where the U.S. could be said to be an expert at it. The society has been exposed to terrorism of an order that few societies can claim. Based on the number of incidents of terrorism. But according to our president, not last year. We didn't see terrorism last year in South Carolina. Not even last year. But this year, we're seeing terrorism. See, so we have to constantly guard against these things that are happening because there is an intention behind it. Nobody's asked the media, well, gee, how did you come up with the fact that this is the worst mass killing in U.S. history? This is what they're saying with a straight face. With this clear knowledge that it couldn't possibly be so. Which, if this is what they're claiming, then what, therefore, do you say to the First Nations people? What do you say to African Americans exterminated by the millions in this country? You erase that history. Your point of entry into history is just the other day. Now, that is violence right there. You've just wiped away responsibility by the government, and by other racist groups, other terrorist groups. You're going to tell me with a straight face that this is the first instance of mass killings in the United States. And none other than the president is telling us this. You see? So there is a reason why this is being treated the way it is being treated, and we've got to call them on it, but more importantly, we have to be very careful. Again, this does not in any way reduce the enormity of this tragedy. But the good thing, if there you could say that, is that we should see how important it is that these victims of a horrible crime, they would have been dismissed. Or say, all right, well, yes, we're sorry, it's a bad thing, and life goes on. But because They come from a politically powerful group. They are protected by that group. And this is a global pressure. The victims will have some measure of protection. Their families would have some measure of protection because the work has been done and continues to be done to galvanize political power globally so that the president of the United States, whoever it happens to be, will have to answer globally. You see, this is what my point is. This is now no longer a local issue or state issue. This has become a form of global protection. And this is the great lesson here. Do you think for a minute, if this were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they say, well, they look at the population targeted and attacked. They look at the racial background of the so-called gunman. They say, well, this was a tragic event. They may even have dismissed this as a kind of ethnic crime. The people killed, you know, they would have thought of it as a very sad thing. But that would have been the extent of political responsibility and social responsibility. This thing would have been news for a good 2 days, 3 days. But this is no longer happening. Because their political identities transcended their sexual identities. And a political organization that is has a global presence is now absolutely, absolutely flexing its muscles. So this is not going to be disappearing under the rug. The effort, however, is to manage it, not in terms of the social responsibility of a system to the victims and their families, but to manage it in the name of public policy and foreign policy in an election year. That's where the rubber meets the road, and we have to be very careful about that. I want to switch now and talk about the Democratic primary in Washington, D.C. Yesterday's primary yielded a predictable victory for Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. She got 78.7% of the vote, and 16 additional delegates who presumably will supercharge, it's already supercharged, but further supercharge her claim to the party's nomination at its convention next month. Well, what is interesting about the primary in Washington, D.C., is that one would expect, that you'd hear some kind of local issues tied to the Democratic primary. There were no local issues tied to the primary. The only issue was, you're going to vote for Hillary, right? That was it. That was pretty much it. Here is a predominantly black city. It's changing, but it's still hanging in there as a large black constituency where we've discussed on this program, the issue for many is whether it should be a state. It has remained as a kind of colony. It is a colony. it literally is being handled by Congress, despite the fact that it has no vote in Congress. It has no rights. Here's a case of taxation without representation. If ever there was one in modern history, this is it. Here's a situation where you would think the local population would be obsessed about this question of self-rule. Washington, D.C., after all, was designed by black folks. Right in the shadow of the White House was slavery. A black man, Benjamin Banneker, designed Washington, D.C. It's the quintessential black world. But it has no political representation in Congress to speak of. It has a kind of shadow ceremonial representation, but it is a colony and has been since its official designation as a District of Columbia. Now, you would think that this would be at front and center of any political discussion that has to do with where you're going to put your vote. Turns out, it didn't even come up. It didn't matter. It didn't matter to Hillary Clinton. It didn't matter even to Bernie Sanders. It was not on the radar at all. Well, that's bad enough. Here's what's worse. There were three council seats available. Three. And you had the election of three establishment types, including the former mayor of Washington, D.C. He got reelected again. He says, this is Mayor Vincent Gray, who was under federal investigation for practically his whole term in office. But he won again, so he's back. And two other seats have been won by outsiders. But you know, there's no such thing as a Democratic outsider. You, Dinah Washington says, is you is or is you ain't. And most of them say, I is. Okay, you're a Democrat. But what was very significant here, in a predominantly black district, okay, was that there were no alternative candidates for these three seats. There was no Republican candidate running against the Democrats. I guess they looked around and said, well, that's not going to work. But there was no Republican candidate. But more significantly, there was no D.C. statehood candidate. There was no Green Party candidate. There was no Rainbow Coalition candidate running for office in Washington, D.C. So I said, well, maybe it's a foregone conclusion that until the end of time, Washington, D.C. will be decidedly Democrat, no matter what. But it occurs to me that we should look at this as a failure. And what is wrong with third party movements? They're not doing the work. Here you have a predominantly black city where people are receptive. They're open to your ideas. Why? Because they're experiencing hell in Washington, D.C. They're being run out of their neighborhoods. We have an unchecked gentrification going on. They're shutting down the schools. You know the story, the typical story. Unemployment is high. Crime is high. the possibilities of a good life are fast diminishing in Washington, D.C. And yet you have a whole bunch of people who are doing so well. So you have a lot of people amenable, at least, to being approached, to hear a different message. They're open to conversion, political conversion, if you will. And you have an opportunity, and this didn't just crawl up on you. People know what the political schedules are. You have a DC council, to the extent that it has any kind of power. Let's say you're going to join some effort to galvanize the power that you have locally. You start where you live. But we have no alternative parties. We have no infrastructure to accommodate a credible candidacy in Washington, D.C. How is this possible? That means they're not doing the work. Or it means there's no interest in doing the work. So you can't blame the Democrats for winning. If we have alternative parties that are actually, you know, they're clocking out. They're not in the fight. And this is by choice. They're not building the infrastructure, and they're not going into the community and organizing. And so they cede their authority, C-E-D-E, cede their authority, give up their authority, give up their potential power, give up their potential political base to the Democrats. They just give it to them. And yet the issue here is self-determination. So they're endorsing the view that this district does not deserve self-determination. We're going to be beholden to the Democrats for the rest of our lives. And yet we are literally at the seat of the nation's capital, and we're opting out of the fight. Which is why I keep saying, why are you going to tell me that the Green Party is a good choice? They're not working. The attitude is, you will come to us because you will recognize how good we are and what a wonderful alternative we are, and it's your job to come to us. We don't have to come to you. We don't have to organize you. We talked about the Rainbow Coalition. Here is a perfect example of what happens when a movement that could have spawned candidacies. I talked about it. That's what the Rainbow Coalition should have done since 1984. If you didn't capture the presidency, and nobody expected that Jesse Jackson would, but it should have spawned political activity at the local level. It's a long-haul fight. You lay the groundwork to construct a political infrastructure that could redeem this very significant black constituency from political slavery. You should have no end of choices in Washington, D.C., alternative to the Democratic Party. But they're not building anything. It is hard, tedious, very unsexy work. You actually have to go out and organize people. You actually have to knock on doors. You have to do some serious sweating. And nobody's interested in doing that. And yet they will point their fingers and say, well, this party is not doing the job, and this one is not the best candidate, and so forth. But you're choosing between the devil and the deep blue sea. You have no alternative to offer anybody. And yet you have a predominantly black district. Not only is it predominantly black, here's what's beautiful about Washington, D.C. It's internationally black. Washington, D.C. is the black diaspora. So you have two fronts on which to fight and galvanize your power. They're not doing the work. Plain and simple. They have no interest in doing it. So after a while, when you hear all the criticisms of what's not happening and so forth, you say, you are not doing your job. And this is why we have to publicly cancel the insurance policies of these people who've been riding on our coattails for a long time. Jesse Jackson to this day has not been made to be accountable for his political treachery and impeding political progress by refusing to continue organizing the Rainbow Coalition as a political structure that at every single level should sustain credible candidacies all throughout the United States, especially in those states where he had such a great showing. We're seeing that, unfortunately, with Bernie Sanders. I mean, you're running against Hillary Clinton in Washington, D.C., and you have nothing to say to the people about the issues that are directly affecting them. Your thing is, this is how I see the world. I'm fighting for the $15 minimum wage. I'm right on the ecology and the environment and all this kind of stuff. You are no way connected to what is happening at ground zero in Washington, D.C. Nor are you indicating, even at this moment, with the conclusion of the primary cycles, what you're going to do with all those votes, except hand them over to Hillary. You are not indicating, Mr. Sanders, that you are going to change course, and radically so. You're going to construct a political architecture, a political infrastructure that would outlive you, and that would solve the problem of Washington, D.C. being the eternal colony, precisely because it is predominantly black. But Hillary has already, I talked about Hillary Clinton being a prime example of plantation politics in the Democratic Party. So it comes out of the plantation system, and it maintains itself as such. The only use that she has for black people in Washington, D.C., just get out there and, you know, flick that lever that says Hillary Clinton and then get lost. And she will come out and, you know, put on that southern drawl that kind of says, well, you know, I imagine this is how black folks talk. And then I'll go to the local eatery and have some collard greens and prove how black I am. And that's enough for you. We are not discussing anything remotely connected to your survival and your interests. And if we do, it will be a purely academic exercise. Has nothing to do with me committing myself to delivering anything. But you and your leaders and your pastors better get out there and bring me the votes. You are, after all, on my political plantation. So yesterday's primary in Washington, D.C. came and went. No big deal. No great shakes. And yet, Washington, D.C. should have been the epicenter of this whole move, this whole realization, the whole reevaluation of the black electorate of their relationship, if you want to call that a relationship. It's a bit one-sided with the Democratic Party. It also should remind us that there's nothing else in place. And I point the finger directly at these so-called independent movements that refuse to go into the communities, that refuse to believe that the black electorate has any special needs that they need to come and find out about and articulate some kind of response, a cogent response to them, and have it as a kind of an involved process in which people tell you what it is they need instead of you telling them what you think they need. This is what is happening. And again, we are in the moment where we should be observing all of this and making it clear that we cannot afford to repeat this pattern. It has to end now. This self-destructive pattern has got to end. There is no benefit, or very little benefit, to say you were with the Democratic Party as a black person or as a Latino. What is it doing for you? What exactly is Hillary Clinton saying or Bernie Sanders saying to the people in Washington, D.C. that allows us to appreciate the fact that they understand the historicity of it, the importance of it, the importance of the struggle within it? This is not part of the discussion. You're just another bunch of black people whose job is to go out there and vote for Hillary. And if you doubt it, your pastor will remind you. And that sycophantic leader that you have, whose job is to please the hierarchy, they will remind you. So these are the things that we should be thinking about when situations present themselves. They are stark reminders of the work we have yet to do, and to seriously commit ourselves to doing it. People have to commit themselves to rejecting things like this. The Democratic Party has to be rejected. It must be destroyed. It has no relevance at all, no benefit at all to the African American and Latino community, to any community for that matter. It's proceeding with a plan that you have no participation in at all. And this year we saw how corrupt, openly corrupt the process is. Well, after all, Hillary Clinton is involved. So it must be crooked and corrupt. That's the only way they roll. But we will nonetheless, these two communities in particular, African Americans and Latinos, will be singularly responsible for creating history. Despite the fact that their eyes are being gouged out, their interests universally ignored, and in fact, they will be used purely as stepping stools to history. The situations exist. These things are coming to our attention to remind us of the work yet to be done. It is to our collective detriment to ignore the lessons here, inherent here. But we must pay attention, and we must keep our minds intact. We have to secure our brains because they are in the direct crosshairs of the system or multiples of systems. Thanks so much for listening today. I hope that something was of value to you. You let me know at leadstories@gmail.com. Stay tuned. Keep it right here. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories@gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. This week is our talking week. We'll talk right through it. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
I'm spinning like a tower.